In September 1588, Sir Thomas Cavendish, an English explorer and, let's just call him, a pirate, arrived back into London following a lengthy trip around the world. He returned to the capital a hero, with vast riches and intelligence snatched from England's arch-enemy, Spain. But Thomas did not arrive back in England alone, for within his party were five men that he had captured, and these five men all happened to be from different parts of Asia. Three were from the Philippines, and two, Christopher and Cosmos, from Japan. Christopher was presented as a gentleman, and it is he that is the main subject of today's discussion. Such was Christopher's instant celebrity that he even had an audience with Queen Elizabeth I aboard Cavendish's ship, the Desire. To tell this amazing story, a story largely unknown to those in the West, I am pleased to welcome Tom Lockley onto the podcast. Tom is based in Japan and has spent the past 8 years researching the story of Christopher with his book, A Gentleman from Japan, The Untold Story of an Incredible Journey from Asia to Queen Elizabeth's Court, acting as the basis for our discussion. The book is due for release in May across the USA, with a UK release date to be announced. But until then, I hope you enjoy the episode as we uncover the fascinating and surprising story of the moment when the last of the Tudor monarchs was introduced to the very first person from Japan to ever set foot on British soil. Welcome back to the Tudor Chess Podcast, episode 29, A Gentleman from Japan, with Tom Lockley. Welcome to the Tudor Chess Podcast, Tom Lockley. It's lovely to have you here with us. How are you doing?
Thank you very much for having me. It's a cold day here in Tokyo, but I'm in a nice warm house, so not so bad. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Very, very welcome. So before we get into the meat of the conversation of why you're here today, just to help people get to know you in a bit more detail, just a few questions. So it would be good to hear a bit about your background, where you grew up and what you do full time. You also just very briefly mentioned there that you're based in Japan.
Yeah, I'm originally born in London, SE13, grew up in Luton, and I've lived on and off in Japan for 24 years now, the last 15 in Chiba, which is just near Tokyo. And I work for a university, Japan's biggest university, called Nihon University.
So what sparked your interest for history? Was it something from when you were quite young, or has it sort of developed over time?
Both, actually. My grandfather would have the credit for introducing me to serious history, I would have thought, John Weigel. But as I developed as a teacher and a researcher, I found that history basically is the basis for almost everything. So although I'm originally a language teacher of French and German and latterly English as well, I found out that people want to hear history stories when they're learning languages, and they're more likely to learn languages if they're fascinated by the stories. So I started writing short stories for my students. And as they got more popular with the students, I started going further. My first book was in 2019, and that was about the African samurai who served the Japanese warlord Oda Nobunaga. Released in the UK as Yasuke. That's his name. And this is the second book, slightly belated because of COVID, but 8 years after research started, it's coming out now.
So would you describe yourself as, because the subject of the conversation today is your book that you've got coming out shortly, and we'll come into the detail of that in a bit more detail. But it's ultimately about a Japanese man who spent some time at the court of Elizabeth I. So how do you describe what history you're interested in? Would you describe yourself as someone passionate about the Tudor era, or are you a historian of Japanese history, and this has happened to have a sort of Tudor slant to it, if that makes sense.
Correct. I am a historian of Japan, and in fact, I had to relearn Tudor history from zero. I found out everything I'd been taught in school and before was virtually irrelevant in modern historical research terms, and started from zero. I didn't realize that when I started the book. Otherwise, I might not have started the book. But that was the way it went. I was on sabbatical at SOAS in London in 2018, doing the research on the ground for the book. Then found out that I needed a lot more Tudor history. I bought about around 100 books, brought them back here, plonked them in my office, and started reading. So hopefully, I have had various qualified historians of the right era go through it. And so far, they've all given it the go-ahead. So I think it's going to be okay on the Tudor front. But primarily, yes, I am a historian of the Japanese era, which is at the same time as the Tudors. So hopefully there's a bit of taste of both, which should give readers who are used to a more insular or European, Eurocentric Tudor history, something slightly different from what they've had before, which was my aim.
And I think, having read the book, I think that's absolutely going to be the case. I think that's what's so fascinating about what you've written, and why I was really keen that you come onto the podcast, is because the story you're telling, I think, is just one that's going to really surprise a lot of people and sort of open their minds to the fact that travel on the scale that you describe and that you talk about in your book was something that people experienced at the time. And that, yes, you know, now we know that there were people of color at the court of the Tudors. And, you know, the fact that your story is ultimately about a Japanese man, well, two Japanese men ultimately, but predominantly this young Japanese guy who is at the court of Elizabeth I for a period of his life. It's just an astonishing story.
I mean, to say at the court, he visited the court. There's no evidence that he was there for very long. However, what's more pertinent to the Tudors as a whole is his effect in London on the literati, if you like, the scientists, or they called themselves naturalists rather than scientists in those days, has a slightly different meaning today. That threw me. But it was more his effect on the intellectual life of London as opposed to the court itself. The court itself, of course, is very glamorous and lovely, and is a very... The connection with the court would have opened all those doors that then allowed England to develop a compass, for example, or helped England develop a compass, which then developed into an empire. From a small instrument like a compass and maps, then you can start to travel. Without those, you can't do anything. So Christopher's influence upon map-making, compasses, and other scientific endeavours, I think, is his far-reaching legacy.
So on the subject of Christopher and the book, so your story predominantly explores the life of a Japanese man who has the Western name of Christopher assigned to him. Obviously, that wouldn't have been the name that he was given at birth, but he's known as Christopher. But your story opens with Thomas Cavendish, who is an English knight who is preparing to basically take on one of, if not the most ambitious journey around the world sort of ever seen at this point. In fact, you describe it as being like the equivalent of going to Mars today. So firstly, who was Thomas Cavendish? How did he come to be a central part of Elizabeth's court?
Thomas Cavendish was a squire, actually, not a knight. It's often thought that he was a knight. The reasons why he didn't become a knight are delved into in the book, and I'm not going to give that part away. You'd have to read the book. He was a squire from Trimley in Suffolk, which is basically now where the biggest container port in the UK is located. So as you can tell, the location on the sea is an excellent one. And it was then as it is now. It's just up the river from Ipswich, and therefore it was in the centre of shipbuilding, the shipbuilding industry for most of England at the time. It was one of the centres. He was the only son of his father, who died young. He inherited at 12, and therefore he was very rich, very young. He had a lot of money, and he was somewhat of a daredevil. He's an interesting character. He spent most of that money on a ship called Elizabeth, and that was fitted out to go to North America on the Roanoke expedition. He was second in command of that expedition. I can't remember the age, but he can't even have been 20 by that point. So it shows how much money spoke in those days. He had places at court, but I hear that perhaps because of his youth, many people were keen to keep him away from Elizabeth. And so he didn't actually have, there's no secure records of him being with Elizabeth at the court, although she certainly gave him his orders. We have those in writing, so we know that, of course, she was aware. His sister, Anne, was one of Elizabeth's waiting ladies in waiting. So, again, that pans out in the book as well later on. So I won't go into that part too much. But he was one of that squirearchy, that very, very high level, rich landowning families, but not of the top level. Maybe second to third level.
Yeah, the sort of the gentry level. So he wouldn't have necessarily had a position at court of note, but was a known commodity, I suppose.
Well, he's a Cavendish, and the Cavendish family are one of, and still are, one of the most ancient aristocratic families. His line was not the one of Chatsworth. It was a different line. It was the Ipswich line, but the name resonates with people even today. He died without issue himself, so his line died out with him. But his plan was daring. He was the first person to plan a trip around the world. The previous two circumnavigations had been done by mistake. And therefore, his was a totally audacious undertaking. I mean, like going to Mars, I describe it, and I still think that it's like going to Mars. They didn't actually know what would have been necessary. They weren't quite sure how they were going to do it. Whereas people had bungled through beforehand, he was trying to do this in what we now call a scientific way. He planned the charts. Well, as far as possible. Of course, they didn't have charts of most of the way they were going. It just was unknown. So I think it's a really ballsy thing to do.
I think that's the thing that always astonishes me about these men like Walter Raleigh and Francis Drake and Thomas Cavendish, who put themselves in, frankly, such colossal danger. But just the fact that they were able to accomplish this in an age where, you know, they didn't have electricity, they didn't have the ability to pull up Google Maps and go, oh, you know, we need to do a left. It's astonishing that they were able to achieve what they did ultimately by, you know, very rudimentary means. It's just an extraordinary achievement that they were able to do this.
They didn't even have compasses that worked. The compasses, by the time they got outside of European waters, the compasses wouldn't have worked properly. They didn't have charts. They didn't have sextants. They didn't have most of even the navigation equipment, which 100 years afterwards would have been a standard. Literally, they were just going off in a direction, hoping to get where they went. It is astonishing. The rudders, they had these things called rudders or routier from the French routier. And the pilots that had been there before would write down the shoals, or there's a mountain there, there's a tree that you can notice, or there's a village or a town here. And that was it. So if they got to the wrong part of the Brazilian coast, for example, they had no idea whether to turn right or left. There was no Google Maps, as you quite succinctly put it. They'd have to take a settlement and torture that out of the people that lived there, basically. And that was unfortunately how it was done. They weren't actually very nice people. They went around pillaging and burning.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing, isn't it? That we tend to view these characters as having a sort of slightly dark glamour to them, but ultimately they were pirates.
They were pirates with a legal veneer of respectability given them by the court, which was essentially paid for by piracy. So the Lord High Admiral's salary, for example, came entirely from privateering piracy. He took 15% of every single privateering cargo that arrived in the country, or the parts which were declared to him anyway. I'm sure there's plenty more that wasn't declared and got taken out in nefarious ways. But yeah, the whole military apparatus of Elizabethan England was paid for by piracy.
So I think underpinning the story that you've written is the long-standing, contentious and often quite volatile relationship between England and Spain. So can you set the scene for firstly why Thomas Cavendish wanted to take this journey and why was Spain such an issue? And sort of what was the draw to the East? What was Japan offering that Thomas Cavendish was so desperately trying to seek?
Well, Thomas Cavendish didn't know he was seeking Japan. He was seeking Cathay, which was a loosely defined area somewhere on the east of Asia, which nobody was quite sure where it was. So he was not in particular seeking Japan, though. If he got there, he would have been happy for it. He was seeking whatever happened to be out there. The Spanish issue goes back to Henry VIII, of course, and Catherine of Aragon. And the split from the Pope as a result of their divorce, or rather the other way around, isn't it? And then the antagonistic relationship which came from there, kind of reinvigorated by Mary and Philip II, or he wasn't Philip II at the time, but Philip's marriage. He was King of England for a few years, which most people forget, a consort. And then, of course, destroyed when Elizabeth came to power. Though Philip did, in a roundabout way, propose to Elizabeth, so that things could have turned out quite different if that had happened. However, the Cold War and Hot War and Cold War and Hot War between Spain and England was basically decades and decades old, and Cavendish was basically doing what he saw as his national duty by going out and burning as many Spanish possessions as possible. By this point, Portugal was also a part of the Habsburg crown in the Iberian Union. There was no country called Spain at the time. As such, it was the Iberian Union, and Portugal was part of it. So the fact that they went to Brazil, even though that was a Portuguese colony, so to speak, was also under Philip II's control. Ultimate control, anyway. And therefore, it was more of an Iberian problem than purely a Spanish problem. It was the only way the English could hit back. They had no army, they had no real navy. There was a few ships that Elizabeth owned, but they were infrequently crewed, and often by impressed people rather than actual professional sailors. And therefore, the only way they could hit back was by doing this in a secret way, the privateering. Elizabeth could deny any knowledge of what was going on the other side of the world by her order, but she could deny that she'd given the orders. Privateering was just such an affront for, as you say, piracy.
Yeah, it was a good get out of jail free card, essentially.
Correct. If you look at what some countries are doing in the Middle East right now, Iran, for example, they're doing something very similar. They're sending forces which they can plausibly deny the existence of, Russian mercenaries in Africa. This is exactly the same way. You can plausibly deny that those orders have come from the top. However, I mean, everybody knows that they have. And in Philip II's case, he would have known exactly what Elizabeth was doing, but there was always a veneer of secrecy there. So these tactics are as ancient as history is. Having a proxy army or a proxy navy, which you can deny you had anything to do with, whatever depredations they get up to. And this continues today as well.
So the first chapter of your book explores an attack by Thomas Cavendish on a Spanish ship, the Santa Ana, and that's how we meet Christopher. So where did this take place and how did the attack play out?
This took place off California, Lower California, as it's now called in Mexico, right at the north of Mexico. And essentially, Cavendish had found out that this galleon was coming from intelligence. He captured people further south in America, around where what is now Ecuador, and he had got the information that this galleon would be there. He waited with his men for a month, and eventually the galleon turned up. They must have been almost as surprised as the galleon was to see them, because they couldn't tell whether the intelligence was 100% accurate or whether it's reliable or not. It could be a trap. However, it was worth the risk. They chased the galleon for nearly a day, and once they morning, probably more accurately, and once they caught up with it, they bombarded it. They tried to board. They were repulsed. The mast was hit by cannon fire and fell over. And essentially, then it was a game of cat and mouse. So just going round and round, shooting and shooting and shooting until the captain decided that he either gave up or died, and the ship went down. And they gave up. They just about got it to shore, and it was in a totally wrecked state by that point. Then it took 2 weeks for them to unload as much of the booty onto Desire, Cavendish's ship, as possible. They probably got no more than 10%, more likely 5% of the goods on that ship, and it is estimated to have been the equivalent of £125,000 at that time. That's something like £50 million in modern day terms, I believe. You may have more accurate figures than that. It was very hard to find out exactly how much that could be in purchasing power today. Whatever it was a huge amount of money. It's probably the biggest ever taking of a Spanish ship by any English person, and therefore it was celebrated when it eventually became known in England. It was again like going to Mars and coming back, except with a whole load of booty along with it.
I mean, it seems astonishing that there was that much money on board the Santa Ana, so much wealth. So, based on what you're saying, the fact that realistically they were only able to sort of transfer 5% of it, does that just by definition tell us that the size of the ships was
Oh,
massively,
yeah, absolutely.
there was a huge difference there, and that was ultimately what was driving the fact that they could only take a small fraction of what they actually had snatched, essentially.
Correct. But you've all the difference in size of ships. Santa Ana is probably five, possibly six or seven times bigger than Desire. That's number one. Content, the second ship, also took some of the booty. We're going to talk about that later, I believe. So, and also, of course, you can't just put the booty. You've got to have water. You've got to have food. You've got to have space for the people who live on the ship as well. You can't just fill it up with treasure. How much of the ship could be filled with treasure? I would estimate probably half, at maximum, because the amount of water to fill a ton is a lot of water by definition. But without that, you're not going to get anywhere. You're going to end up parched and dead in the middle of the Pacific. So, water, wine, they didn't have any beer. They got the wine from the Spanish that time. Food, everything would have taken up a huge amount of space, not to mention having enough space to move the cannon and fire the cannon. They may have decided to put the cannon away to fit in more stuff, but that would have been a big risk because they were about to go to Manila or to the Philippines and to other hostile territories when they would quite possibly need to use those cannon very effectively. And if they couldn't do that, they would have lost everything. So it was a massive gamble. You can't just take the loot. You've got to work out exactly how much of everything you can balance out to maximize the profit.
Yeah. And the fact that even though they only walked away with at best 10% of the total value of what was on board, the fact that that was still seen as a massive success, I suppose, tells us just how vast the riches on that ship would have been, that even though they only took a relatively small portion of it was still enough to transform the lives of the men who survived the entire journey.
Absolutely. And if you look at it in the terms of how much of the national wealth of England that would have been at the time, it's estimated that Queen Elizabeth at that time, her entire annual budget, this is for everything, is about £300,000. If you're bringing in £125,000 of loot, that's nearly half. I mean, that's an estimate of 300,000. It might be 250, in which case it would have been half of the entire annual budget of England arriving at once. Gold prices plummeted after this, and it caused economic disturbance. Although we can't, the documents sadly do not remain for us to look at the entire economic factors that ensued from this. But it's yeah, these are unbelievable figures for Elizabethan England, and it would have also been a shock to Spain. Spain had many, many, many different streams of gold, rivers of silver coming into it. England had none, but was looking very hard to find some, and in the meantime, stole them from the Spanish. But at the same time, that would have been a huge dent in the Spanish coffers. That money would have been used to armies and armadas to attack England as one of the things that it would have been used for. And therefore, that money not arriving in Spain was a huge deal. It wasn't just people getting rich. That was a massive, massive dent in Philip II's means of war.
Yeah, which for Elizabethans could only be a good thing, given the ongoing hostilities between the two countries.
They couldn't fight in Europe effectively, so they were taking the battle to wherever they could. That is essentially what's happening.
So it's on board the Santa Ana that we discover Christopher, the sort of young Japanese guy who's found his way into onto a Spanish ship. You tell quite a charming story of Christopher telling an inebriated Cavendish a story which Thomas Cavendish enjoys so much that he promptly promotes Christopher. He gives him a more comfortable bed and essentially makes him an English gentleman. So, from what you discovered, how did Christopher firstly end up on this boat, this Spanish boat? And what was the story that he told that so enraptured Cavendish?
Cavendish was about to cross the Pacific Ocean, something that only one English crew had ever done before, that under Drake, and they didn't know where they were going. So he was about to do this. He needed everybody from that Spanish ship that had any expertise. So he essentially would have interviewed anybody that looked like they might be useful to him. They took a Spanish pilot, Thomas de Azola. They took several Africans who could speak Moorish languages, which could be used in Indonesia, Arabic, etc., that could be used in Indonesia to communicate. They took three Filipino boys that could hopefully be used in the Philippines to communicate and to give intelligence about that area, and two Japanese men, by Elizabethan standards, 20 and 17, who they could read and write. I mean, this was the thing that most flabbergasted Cavendish probably, and it was commented so many times on by English scholars over the next few years. They could read and write their own language, and in those days, not that many could read and write any language, let alone Japanese or possibly Chinese, as it might have been. And also, Christopher, as we later find out from diary entries and letters in Europe, in various different languages, was a navigator. He had navigational skills and navigational knowledge that nobody else in England would have had. He was the ideal person to take to England and kickstart a knowledge of the East in England. Nobody had actually been able to do that in person before. For Cavendish, this was almost as valuable as a treasure because he could say that he was the first person to bring this crucial knowledge to England. And he was. And he's remembered for it.
So, although we can't say for definite, do you think this is quite possibly the very first time a Japanese person had been to England?
Oh, we can say for definite, it was definitely the first time. It's definitely the first time any East Asian had ever been to England. That there are some supposedly Chinese skeletons from Roman times. However, since Roman between Roman times and the 16th century, we can say with 99% assuredness that nobody from East Asia had been to the British Isles, and nobody had been recorded ever in any kind. We've only about the Chinese people because their bones were discovered, and archaeology has told us that they were Chinese. There's nobody else before Christopher recorded in any kind of writing. But Christopher's arrival is recorded in at least 10 sources, probably more, that we have lost, and in quite deep detail as well.
His name, Christopher, his the English, the anglicized name. Do you have any sense on where that came from?
Well, it would have probably have been Cristobal in Spanish first, or perhaps in Portuguese, Cristobal. He may never have had a Japanese name. It's entirely possible. And the reason for that is because he may have been enslaved as a baby or a child and been given that by Catholics in the first place. It's possible. He may have had a Japanese name which was forgotten, and that was his baptismal name. We know that Christopher himself had spent some time in Manila or other parts of the Philippines, and therefore he was within the Spanish sphere. There were lots of Japanese people connected to Manila at the time. Many of them do have baptismal names suggesting that they had been baptized as Christians. Yeah, I can't do any more conclusions than that. I really wish I could. But that's why I don't even make any attempts. In my past book about Yasuke, an African who came to Japan, I looked very deeply into where his name could have come from, and it was much easier to find out. It's very similar to the Portuguese name Isaac, for Ishak, for example. But this Chris, I did try, but there was no way that any conclusions could be drawn, so I just left that out of this book.
Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes there's just you just have to accept the reality that you're not going to find out why something was the way it was, and you've just got to live with it, essentially, even if it is frustrating.
And he's immortalized as Christopher. That's the name by which all of the sources refer to him. If they refer to his name at all, that's the name. So therefore, that is him, I think. I'm happy with that.
So the two primary ships that were under Thomas Cavendish's control were named Desire and Content, respectively. Content vanished without trace. So, what led to this? And are there any theories that you were able to uncover that might explain what happened?
Part of them going to the Pacific was to find a way through the Northwest Passage from the north, right the northwest, the other side of the Americas. Content was supposedly, it is secret, but everybody agrees research-wise that Content was sent further north, past California, past Oregon, all the way through Canada to find that entrance to the Northwest Passage, which would have meant so much for England. The thing about England was they couldn't easily get past the Americas or the Africas in the south because the Portuguese and Spanish controlled those passes, those straits. They couldn't easily get to either of the northways because nobody knew the Northwest or the Northeast Passage. They're all hypothesized. Nobody knew the way. Several hundreds of English people had died over Siberia, frozen to death. Others had frozen to death or basically given up halfway trying to get above Canada. And this was the first real attempt. Some people think that Drake tried to do it, but then didn't. Kind of chickened out, kind of thing. So this was the first English attempt to actually go that way. It's the first of many. There are probably hundreds over the next several centuries. But it would have been such a coup to find that. That would have been the English American way to Asia. And that would have been, as the book makes clear, for every navigator, for every courtier, for the Queen herself, that would have meant the saving of Britain. That was where all those rivers of silver and gold were going to come from. To equal the Spanish, equal the Ottomans, equal the French, who were all the rich men of Europe at the time. England had no chance unless it could find that, as far as the English were concerned. They didn't, not yet. And that's why England doesn't really figure on the superpowers of Europe until the early 18th century.
After the capture of the Santa Anna and the taking of the booty, Christopher becoming, for want of a better word, seen as an English gentleman, Cavendish begins to make the journey back to England. It takes weeks and weeks and weeks, but Christopher is safely on board, and they eventually arrive back into England on the 9th of September 1588, by which point the Spanish Armada's failed. Elizabeth is obviously victorious. So, what was Cavendish's intention to do with Christopher now that they were back on English soil? Was he there to basically show off this Japanese man to the English court? What did he intend to do with him?
Well, Cavendish didn't know about the defeat of the Spanish Armada, nor did he know about one other very important thing that just happened, the death of Robert Dudley, which threw Queen Elizabeth totally, may have caused her extreme depression, which comes into how Cavendish didn't become a knight at the time as well. Cavendish's idea was to show off these gentlemen of the East, and it wasn't just Christopher, there was five of them. Gentleman meaning not just somebody nice that opens doors for ladies as we think of it today, but actually the concept of gentry, as you used earlier, a nobleman essentially. And there weren't that many in England at the time, only a few hundred, coming up to a few thousand perhaps by the end of the Tudor period. And therefore, this was a very high rank. Now, the key point why this actually matters is because another group of Japanese nobles, real nobles this time, not fake nobles, real Japanese nobles had just been to see Philip II and the Pope, and they'd been feted all over Europe. There's something like 200 publications still in existence about their visit. They were given the citizenship of Rome, they were made members of the Senate, and they were knighted in Rome. So they became European knights at the same time as Japanese nobles. Of course, because this was a Catholic procession around Europe, the English had nothing to do with it. And Elizabeth was not happy about this. She was furious. And so Cavendish's concept was to bring Elizabeth her own nobles. And there's a lovely a piece of evidence in a letter from the Venetian ambassador to Paris reporting that these gentlemen of the East had come to see the Queen. So, out of a desire to see the Queen is how he put it. Therefore, as far as Cavendish is concerned, he was one, stoking Queen Elizabeth's ego, and number two, he was repeating the feat that Catholic Europe had succeeded in doing only a couple of years before, which was welcoming these gentlemen of the East and honoring them as special visitors. He had no right to give anybody a rank of gentleman. Cavendish was simply a squire himself, so he made it up. I'm not going to go too much into those details right now or what happened afterwards. Some of it's unclear, some of it isn't, but it's kind of the crux of the book, so I'll leave readers to find that out. But essentially, it was a con.
You definitely describe Christopher and Cosmas's, and the other gentlemen who from Asia who make their way to England as it almost being like a sort of hysteria sort of celebrity moment in many respects. It's a bit like, it's almost like the Beatles, that these gentlemen who look nothing like the people in England looked, were for all intents and purposes from a different world. So I don't think we can't really un we can't underestimate enough just how, for want of a better word, exotic and sort of new this must have felt for Elizabethans.
You're absolutely right. Hakluyt rewrote a portion of the introduction to his great work. Another person, Robert Park, rewrote his whole the whole dedication to his book, which he dedicated to Cavendish, to mention these guys, to mention that they could speak English, to mention that they didn't mind the weather, which is my favorite part.
We're talking about it even
Yeah.
then.
Yeah, the weather was worse in those days, apparently, a lot worse in those days. and they're arriving in November in London, so it's going to be snowing probably. I did check, it didn't, the Thames didn't freeze over that year, which is a shame because that would have been a lovely detail to have in the book. But sadly, it wasn't to be. And there's the lads of great intelligence. The words used about them were, the adjectives used about them were extremely praising. Furthermore, this was seen, as we can see from many of these other little nuggets of information we get, they were supposed to be the interpreters when the next mission would actually reach Japan, or the China, or somewhere, and these guys would be the key, essentially. If you just turn up on a foreign coast with no language or no interpreters or the wrong gifts, for example, you're going to get hung as pirates, which is what they were, ironically. But if you turn up with an interpreter who can smooth things away, and you've also got all sorts of gifts which are appropriate for the ruler or the lords of thereabouts, then you're much more likely to be accepted and listened to. And that was the aim with Christopher and Cosmas. They were supposed to be the key to the East for the English.
Queen Elizabeth I finally meets Christopher when she steps aboard the Desire for sort of what seems like a sort of a lunch and an exchange of gifts and so on. So what actually happened on that day, and did Christopher have a specific role to play?
Again, we don't know the full details of that. However, it's 5 days after they arrived in Greenwich. Desire arrived. It would have been rowed up the Thames. You couldn't use sails for a ship that size from Tilbury. Led off a cannonade. Elizabeth, at the point, was actually in London, probably Whitehall, and was rowed up several days later for this banquet. We have details of the banquet. We have details of how the ship looked and how the people on the ship, the sailors, looked. We don't have much more information than that because it's all been lost, unfortunately. That information comes from a song which was recorded in the Royal Stationery Office. We only know the title of the song. We don't know the contents of the song. Like so much of that time, we just simply don't know the full details. However, Christopher was on that ship. Elizabeth was on that ship. She had a deep interest in meeting Christopher. And according to the Venetian ambassador, he had a deep interest in meeting her. It is inconceivable that Cavendish wouldn't have taken that coup and introduced them. In fact, the most likely thing would have been for a gentleman to be serving the Queen. So if Christopher was being presented as a gentleman, then he was being presented to the Queen as her servant, essentially.
So with that whole thing of being presented as a gentleman, things soon turned quite sour for Cavendish. What happened shortly after that meeting with the Queen?
Well, he never got his knighthood, which everybody is shocked about even today. He came back and gave her tens of thousands of pounds, essentially would have replenished the money spent on the Armada, and would have funded partly the expedition the next year, the English Armada against Spain and Portugal. So, number one, that would have been enough for a knighthood in any age, especially today. And therefore, why didn't he get it? There's also a suggestion of piracy at some point. He had a £2,000 bond not returned to him. He was in debt really quickly. Julius Caesar, one of the prime lawyers and one of his biggest funders at the time, wrote several letters which are still in the state archives, which you can see only a few months later, complaining about not being paid. And these are small sums. He's not being paid £100 or something like that. £80 is not a huge amount of money. And finally, suddenly, there are no references to these men as gentlemen anymore. They are referred to either by no title at all, or they become referred to as naturalists, scientists, scholars. Therefore, this is, and the book does make this clear. I'm not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes, but the supposition here from joining all those dots is that Cavendish's ruse was discovered. Elizabeth was furious, and Cavendish didn't get what he would have expected, which was the knighthood.
So his inventing of these men as gentlemen born essentially gets uncovered, and that's what ultimately changes the sort of the expected trajectory that Cavendish would have gone on to hopefully enjoy.
That's what he would have wanted, yeah.
Yeah.
However, the men are still treated as gentlemen. They're treated very respectfully. They're given other titles to make them into people of respect and worthy of respect, so to speak. And they're also assigned jobs like interpreter, trade advisor, scientific advisor. They help identify plants from the East and also from South America among scholars. They were immediately utilized for other purposes. In fact, although Cavendish would have wanted them to be seen as gentlemen and to have boosted his own status and ego, they were far more useful for England as scholars rather than fake gentlemen, if you like.
So eventually Cavendish decides to organize a second voyage, and Christopher and his countryman Cosmas go along for the journey, but it ends in disaster. What happened on that second voyage?
On that second voyage, luckily, we have a diarist called Knyvett, Anthony Knyvett, who wrote a long account of that voyage. And it, again, very helpfully for us, by Knyvett's own words, him and Christopher were best friends and had been since they left England until a certain incident where their friendship was broken. However, because of that, Christopher gets quite a few observations in this, and we can find out an awful lot more about Christopher. But we find out more about the death and the destruction of that voyage. It was a failure. They left England late due to various factors, partly due to the fact they couldn't collect enough food to get them through. They eventually had to leave without enough supplies, which was almost deadly in the first place, but they did get to Brazil. In Brazil, they were starving and their teeth were falling out due to scurvy already, but they managed to find food. They took the city of Santos, which is where Rio de Janeiro is now, and it's just on the coast down from there. And they basically holed up there for the winter. They invaded on Christmas morning, taking the people at midnight mass as prisoners, and then they would have enjoyed their Christmas feast and the prisoners would have gone hungry. These English sailors were starving by this point, so they wouldn't have had any compunction about doing anything like that. They pulled up in the city, they made a fortress around the city and went out and pillaged as much food as they could, but they still didn't get enough. Eventually, he holds on to try and get more and more food. And again, they leave late to get to the south of South America, Tierra del Fuego, to get through Magellan Straits. Again, they're there several months too late, and all the storms are blowing up. They try and get through several times. Basically, it's even more of a disaster than it was previously. We don't know exactly how many, but dozens and dozens of the crews on the ships die of frostbite, of hunger, of all sorts of other diseases. Most of them, and this is such a poignant thing, hadn't realized that they needed warm clothes. Didn't have warm clothes. They were just in, you're in a t-shirt now, I'm in a t-shirt now. They didn't have t-shirts in those days, whatever the equivalent was. They had no idea that they would have been going through, or they were probably did have the idea, but they were so badly prepared that they didn't have the requisite gear. And so they froze to death. Eventually, they mutinied. Cavendish had to bring them out. He tried to take them back in later on, and they mutinied again. You're left with, in the end, only a few dozen from hundreds. There were 300 that started that expedition in five ships. As far as we know, only several dozen ever made it back to England. And Christopher and Cosmas were not among them, to our knowledge. There's no record of them after the strait. They may well have died in the strait. They may have died later on in raids. at one point, during one raid, 80 men died in one blow when they accidentally jumped off a ship, which was too deep in the water. With their armor and their guns, they just sunk. So, to be honest with you, I could have just written a book about that voyage. As I went through that voyage, taking out the fascination of the Japanese crew members and other crew members indeed as well, that voyage was just such a mess. And then you look at all the other voyages around it and you think they're all such a mess. And this is why the East India Company eventually became incorporated, to deal with this badly planned, this haphazard, amateur way of looking outside of the British Isles in Europe. The East India Company strategized that and put proper money behind it and secured the use of ships and supplies and navigational equipment, which would make sure that fewer people died and the missions could be accomplished. And that was the secret to the East India Company's early success.
So I think it's fair to say that Christopher's story would have been relatively unique for its time, but very, very unusual. The book that you've written is so rich in detail, and yet Christopher's story is essentially a complete unknown. I'd never heard of him. I'd never heard of this story. How did you discover it?
The story of Christopher among historians of Anglo-Japanese relations is not unknown, but not much more than his name and the fact that he was taken off Southern California is normally referred to in the history books. Essentially, I looked at what I had. I mentioned to a very good friend and colleague, Time on the Screech, who used to be at SOAS and is now at the Japan Cultural History Research Center in Kyoto. He said, "Oh, I've been collecting a few of these. They're all yours. Go on, you get on with this." And I looked at those. There's about six. Then I found another three, four, five more sources until we've got possibly 10 or more sources about Christopher. They are limited, but when you put them together, they give you quite a good idea of what's going on. And the tiny details, like he's the first person ever to be observed writing Japanese or any East Asian language in London, for example. Again, this is one of the things that was so remarkable that people wrote it down. And once you put all of them together, you find a rich picture. And then you crystallize it with other information, because we have quite a lot of information about the Tudors. You crystallize it with the other information about Cavendish himself, about other people who are connected with him, other people who wrote about Christopher, Hakluyt, for example, and you get a book.
Yeah, you fill in the gaps, essentially.
You fill in the gaps, you put the jigsaw together, and you recreate the life of a man who, as you just said, had been forgotten. And I think the beauty is that people like Christopher are actually the meat of what made the world. I mean, nobles, aristocrats, great merchants have the money. They put it in, but the people that actually do the dirty work are almost always people like Christopher, who very much are the ones that go out and die on their behalf.
Yeah.
Therefore, in a way, I'm trying to recreate Christopher on behalf of many other hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people like him from other parts of the world and from England as well, who did the work that others got celebrated for.
Yeah, and people who didn't have a voice.
Yeah, people that didn't have a voice. We don't have a single source from Christopher himself. All of it is in news sheets, letters, diaries, books, or random things. Like, we haven't got any pictures for Christopher. There's the ditty that was recorded in the stationer's office, for example, crystallizing together to make a bigger story.
So, final question, when will the book be published and what are you working on next?
The book is published in the USA on 21st of May. The British version has not been 100% decided yet, but I may be able to update you before this podcast comes out. Let's wait and see. Failing that, then the US version will be sellable in the UK. It's called A Gentleman from Japan, and I hope that your listeners are very keen to read it. What am I working on next? I've got two or three proposals in with agencies right now. Let's cross fingers and hope that at least, well, actually, one of them has already been accepted, but I can't say too much detail. It's a Korean story rather than a purely European story. Of course, there will be Europeans in there, and there'll be Japanese and Chinese as well. It's more of an Asian story this time. I'm going back to Asia. My first book was Asia focused, second book, Asia, Europe. I'm going back to Asia for the third one.
Great. Well, thank you again for coming onto the podcast and telling the story of this fascinating man that, yeah, history has forgotten about, but the story is just astonishing, and I'm sure people are going to be really keen to hear what you've had to say, and will no doubt go on to buy the book when it is released in May.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a true honor. And I have to say, listening to your voice today in person here on this recording is so poignant. Having listened to your podcasts, it's like seeing and hearing you in real life is a very different, but it is a lovely experience. So thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Well, thanks again, and we'll speak soon.
Absolutely. It's been lovely to talk to you.
And so that brings us to the end of this week's episode of the Tudor Chess Podcast. My thanks to Tom Lockley for sharing the amazing story of Christopher with us today. If you enjoy the Tudor Chess Podcast, then perhaps you would consider becoming an official patron of the channel. I release a weekly bonus subscriber episode on Patreon and across Apple Podcast subscriptions, as well as further content, live discussions, and so on. To sign up, just head to patreon.com/thetudorchest or search for the podcast in Apple Podcasts. Thank you again, and speak soon.